We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Well, obviously, the three of us managed to survive the heat wave that was striking us last week as beginning to strike us last week as we were recording, but not everybody fared that well.
No, it was a pretty remarkable stretch of days. Of course, Seattle set an all-time record with 108. Portland set an all-time record with 116. And we saw a number of infrastructure issues, particularly pavement buckling on freeways, that happened both in Seattle, in North Seattle and Tukwila, and also in Portland. And it raises the issue again of investing in infrastructure, because we've got decaying roads and bridges that are probably in many cases vulnerable to climate change. This was, according to climatologists, almost certainly a product of climate change. It was unprecedented. And we saw this particularly in BC, up in Western Canada, where the heat dome migrated after it was done here. We saw the town of Lytton in the Fraser Canyon set consecutive records for highest temperature ever recorded in Canada 3 days in a row, topping out on, I believe, Tuesday at 121 degrees. And then on Wednesday, the town was destroyed by a wildfire. That and other wildfires set off a chain of dry lightning of 710,117 lightning strikes recorded in 15 hours in British Columbia and northwestern Alberta. That in turn set off innumerable other wildfires. Fortunately, the smoke from that is blowing north and east right now. We're not getting it. The peach-colored sky that we've had the last few days is actually a result of California fires. But it is a reminder that the fire season is starting early. We are going to get smoke eventually, either from California or BC. And
or possibly Eastern Washington.
Or possibly Eastern Washington. Or Oregon, for that matter. Mm-hmm. There is a big state between California and Washington. So, it's going to be a rough summer, I think. And we haven't even gotten to the COVID update yet. We'll do that in a little bit.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about the – Maria, you started last week doing some comparisons on the mayoral candidates' policies.
Yes, and I promised the homelessness and housing analysis this week.
Oh, dear Lord.
Last week I looked at transportation, covering the transportation forum that was held by the Mass Transportation Coalition. This week I looked back and watched the forum that was held in late May by a group of housing and homelessness service providers, which included groups like the Washington Low-Income Housing Alliance, the Housing Development Consortium, Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness, the Lived Experience Coalition, which is made up of people who have lived experience of homelessness, the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle, the YWCA, and the Mockingbird Society, which is made up of a lot of youth, particularly young people who are exiting the foster care system, who are in or exiting the foster care system, many of whom struggle to afford to get jobs and afford to get, you know, advanced education and to afford living in an expensive city like Seattle. So the forum was attended by five of the six main candidates. Lorena Gonzalez was absent that week because that was the week that she was dealing with a fire in her own home and was struggling to find a new place to live herself. So she was not there, but the others did. But the other five main candidates, the other five of the six main candidates did attend. Now, the questions ranged from how to fund affordable housing and services to how to help renters stay in their apartments to how each candidate would help BIPOC people who make up the majority of the estimated 8,000 homeless folks who live in Seattle currently. Now, in broad strokes, here's where the candidates stand on homelessness and affordable housing issues. And I'm going to take them alphabetically. Colleen Echohawk described herself multiple times as an expert on homelessness and made sure everyone understood that this is the center of her campaign and possibly the one and only issue that she really knows anything about or really cares about. She would seek federal funding to forgive back rent owed by tenants. She's a big believer in and supporter of the Regional Homelessness Authority, and she worked with the Durkin administration to make it happen. So that's something to note. She pledged to have a person working in her office who has lived experience of homelessness and to have a paid intern from the Youth Advisory Board. She also pledged to create 100 outreach jobs for people with lived experience of homelessness, although it wasn't clear how permanent those jobs will be if she's actually able to, quote unquote, solve the homelessness problem in 14 months, end quote, as she is claiming that she will be able to do. I'm not sure I believe that. She wants
That's a notably accelerated timeline from the 10-year plan.
Oh, yes.
Which we're in year 17 now, I believe.
Yeah. She wants to remove regulatory barriers for real estate developers, so that's something to note. And she wants to end exclusionary zoning, expand programs for people of color to purchase homes, and to build accessory dwelling units, which she says will help them build wealth in BIPOC communities and will help to keep families together.
That would explain, by the way, her remarkable fundraising success among real estate developers.
Yeah. And she says she said in this forum that she no longer supports Charter Amendment 29, the Compassion Seattle Charter Amendment, which she initially called good strategy. And since she's been in this forum, other media folks have tried to pin her down on this, and she's notably been very vague and kind of waffled back and forth, saying that there are elements of it that she likes and other elements that she doesn't like. And, you know, one day she'll say, oh, no, I'm not a supporter of Charter Amendment 29. And other days, depending on the audience, she'll say, oh, yes, we need definitely to do some of the things in Charter Amendment 29. So she's not we're not real clear on what she thinks is good or bad about it, because she doesn't really specify. Now, overall, Echohawk seemed really young to me. And I think she's in, you know, I went and looked her up online, and it looks like she's in her mid-40s, but she really comes across as less than half her age, really. She has a lot of energy, but her presentation is unfocused and really scattered. She comes across as very young and very enthusiastic, but not very knowledgeable about the details and the workings of government. And I can see how she might be a good motivator for people working with her or under her, because she has so much energy. But she doesn't come across as having the kind of maturity and skill needed to run a big city government or a very very large organization. So that's my impression of Echohawk. This being the first time I've seen her actually speaking live. Now, Jessen Farrell called herself a fresh start. Farrell would do a lot of bridge building between city government and the county and neighboring cities to make the regional authority work. So she's invested in that. She'd go after state and federal funds for affordable housing and homelessness. She made a point of saying that mortgages are a form of rent control for homeowners and that renters deserve the same kind of stability, but she didn't give any details about what that stability would look like. So I really have no idea if she actually does support rent control for renters. She doesn't support Charter Amendment 29 because it lacks a funding source. That was her main reason for not supporting it. And paternalistically, she told both the Lived Experience Coalition questioner and the youth representative, quote, you are the expert on your own life, end quote.
So, oh, Lord.
Which made me think, oh, no, duh, Jessen.
And today is the first day of the rest of your life.
Yes, yeah. And I know she wants it to come across as warm and personable, but it really kind of came across as talking down to and using a mom tone of voice. And that's, I think, not going to endear her to a lot of folks. Now, she said she would not end exclusionary zoning. She's for rezoning certain types of properties, and she gave the example of the undeveloped Tolaris Conference Center property, which is near the UW, which is no longer being used as a conference center or retreat, and there's all kinds of questions in that neighborhood of what the Tolaris property should be used for. And some groups are saying, let's use it for affordable housing, and some other members of the neighborhood are saying, oh no, you know, let's make it a wetland, etc. So there's been this struggle over the Tolaris property. Clearly, Farrell thinks it would be awesome to use it for affordable housing. So she's for rezoning certain parcels like that in certain neighborhoods to provide a mix of housing, but she did not say she would end single family zoning throughout the city. Now, she touted her plan to do an ST3 for affordable housing. Farrell comes out of the transportation realm. She was former executive director of the Transportation Choices Coalition. So she sees the regional Sound Transit 3 plan as something that can be readapted to plan for and build affordable housing all across the region and not just only in Seattle. And she would solicit money from the federal government, from the county, and from the other cities in the region to try to do that. Now, overall, Farrell was good on the policy, but vague, I think, on the details. In her mannerism, as I said, she was the opposite of Colleen Echohawk, where Echohawk channeled her inner teenager. Farrell was very heavy on the mom voice and mom demeanor. So I found that kind of an interesting contrast. Now, Bruce Harrell, he was more focused in his answers during the homelessness and housing forum than he was during the transportation forum, but he still lapses into word salad whenever he doesn't have a really good answer for whatever question is being asked. His focus on housing will be on quote unquote having a plan and on quote unquote publishing a plan so that, for everything, so that people in Seattle can see that their money is being spent efficiently, right? He supports rapid rehousing, wraparound services, diversion strategies, and cash assistance, all things that the city is already doing. So my guess is he's not going to end any of those programs and might actually expand them, although he didn't say that. He just kind of threw those terms out there as part of the word salad.
And now, you really don't know whether he actually knows what he's talking about.
Exactly. And that's what the issue I have with this whole unfocused delivery is that I'm not sure he isn't just throwing out those terms in order to please people, and maybe he doesn't know what they actually mean. Now, he would pursue all available sources of revenue, including raising tax revenues, but of course he gave no specifics, right? He touted his and again, it's like, okay, raising tax revenues, you just threw that out there as part of the word salad. Do you actually have a plan, or is that just, you know, to get votes? Now, he did tout his Seattle Jobs Center multiple times as a pathway out of homelessness, especially for young people. Again, he didn't give a lot of specific details about what that was, but I think if you go to his website, he probably will have some details about his Seattle Jobs Center. Now, he supports Charter Amendment 29 without reservation. Okay, that's the one big thing to note about him. And he said that he can work with it. That was what he said. He said he didn't see that he would have any problems working with it. When it comes to exclusionary zoning, he said the city should be creative in finding ways to change the zoning laws, but not heavy-handed. And the city should work with neighborhoods on what to change where. So he's for changing zoning piecemeal, like the city council has been doing so far. He again went big on supporting data collection to determine what the city's policies should be on homelessness, housing, zoning, health and safety inspections, healthcare, jobs, education, and a whole bowl of word salad.
And, you know, the city has been collecting a lot of data.
Oh, yes.
Over the past let's say 20 years. Uh-huh. And they have been primarily using it to try and make the elected politicians look good. They have not used it to drive policy.
Yeah.
Except to justify what they already wanted to do, which is to make homeless, you know, try and get rid of homeless people.
He's big on the, you know, it's time for Seattle to use that data for something, but I'm not sure he has any good idea of what that something would be. Now, Andrew Grant Houston, his focus is on progressive revenue to bring in more money for affordable housing, including a 1% flat income tax that he says would generate at least $300 million, which would be spent on equitable development, B&O tax relief, a public development authority for green and social housing, and a green apprenticeship program. But again, income tax, it's not clear that that's legal in Washington state, and you could pass it but not be able to enact it. Now, he supports rent control, which is also not legal in Washington state, but he said he would push hard for the state legislature to change the law to allow it. And I'm guessing that's probably what he would try to do, or else try to work through the courts to get a 1% income tax going. So, you know, more a lot of idealism here, which it's not clear is actually achievable. He would end single family zoning, end the apartment ban, and increase the minimum wage so that BIPOC people can afford to live again in Seattle. He vehemently opposes Charter Amendment 29, saying he's not interested in an attempt to legalize sweeps. Also, the Lived Experience Coalition was not consulted when drafting Charter Amendment 29. So those were his reasons for rejecting it, very different from Justin Farrell's reasons. He would include people with lived experience, with lived experience on his team in the mayor's office. To help homeless youth, he would prioritize education, particularly extending the Seattle Promise Program and increase access to apprenticeships and union jobs for youth exiting foster care. After Casey Sixkiller denied that the city had left any federal funds on the table to deal with homelessness, Houston said that he was the one who actually did the work in his policy research to find out that FEMA funding was available and could be used to house people living on the street. And he was the one who told the city that the money was there, and the city did not pursue it. Houston was very clear on that. The city, he gave them the information and the city did not pursue it. He also said that Lorena Gonzalez had spoken with someone at FEMA to verify that the funding was available and could be used for hotel-based services. But still, the Durkin administration, specifically Casey Sixkiller, her deputy mayor in charge of homelessness, refused to pursue that funding. Which brings us to Casey Sixkiller. He, in the forum, doubled down on the record of the Durkin administration. And, you know, he would have to, because, of course, homelessness is in his portfolio as deputy mayor. He thinks the city has done a good job housing people over the past year, is what he said. But then he went on to say that Charter Amendment 29 is proof that Seattleites think the status quo is not working. Okay, which is it?
How do you square those?
Yeah, are you doing a good job or are you not? He said he supports aspects of Charter Amendment 29, especially the sweeps, because people shouldn't be living in parks. Yes, he thinks people with lived experience of homelessness should be at the table, but so should businesses and neighborhood NIMBYs. So his reason for supporting Charter Amendment 29 is exactly opposite of the reason that Houston gave for vehemently rejecting it. Houston hates the sweeps. Sixkiller loves them, apparently. But he says he supports rezoning, but then didn't say he would end exclusionary or single family zoning. So my guess is it's probably the incremental zoning that the city council has been doing up till now. He touted new policies like a guaranteed basic income that would provide $500 per month for 16,000 families in the city. Okay, that sounds good, right? Although he did admit that the city has 50,000 families that make less than $30,000 a year. So his guaranteed basic income program would only help about one third of those folks. He would build 3,000 units of permanent supported housing over the next 3 years, but gave no specifics on where the money for that will come from. And he said the city has not left any money on the table when it comes to dealing with homelessness services. He bragged up the small amount of shelter space that the city opened so that people who are already in emergency congregate shelters could have more space to deal with the COVID pandemic. And he bragged up the two small hotels that the city opened up under pressure from service providers in the Just Cares program. Again, not really an initiative. Not really a program that was initiated by the city, but was initiated by service providers pressuring the city to do something. Then, of course, Colleen Echohawk was the first person to answer the question after him, and she directly contradicted him. Then she was followed up by all the other candidates, and finally Andrew Grant Houston, who essentially called him a liar. Now, Lorena Gonzalez was not there, unfortunately, but she does have a whole policy on her website on housing and homelessness. And of course, she's been president of the city council during a time when the council has allocated record amounts of money for homelessness services, shelters, affordable housing, and racial equity, and have been struggling to get the Durkin administration to actually spend that money. Now, she would build more temporary and permanent supportive housing. She would improve treatment programs for mental health and substance abuse, convert existing unused buildings and hotel space into non-congregate shelters, improve access to jobs, and increase wages for service providers. For tenants, she would limit rent hikes in unsafe buildings, require 4 months' notice of large rent increases, put a cap on move-in fees and security deposits, and provide rental assistance to low-income Seattleites. She would also end racist exclusionary zoning policies, and her goal is to create 16,000 affordable units from the existing housing stock and add 37,000 new units, but she doesn't give a timeline for that. And to pay for this, she would seek revenue from big businesses and the very wealthy through a wealth tax, but she doesn't have any specifics on her website yet on what that wealth tax would be or who among Seattle's residents would pay, residents and businesses would pay it yet.
You know, at this point, there's like 3 weeks until ballots are mailed. If she doesn't have any specifics yet, she's not going to.
Yeah, that's my guess. So, if asked, she would probably say, well, it needs to be negotiated and worked out with the city council and so forth. And she's very aware of the details of the process, so she would be absolutely correct in that. The mayor can propose something, but the city council is the one who hammers it out and makes it, you know, something that they can all agree on and that they think is workable. So now the takeaway from all this, Casey Six Killer literally got his head handed to him by the other candidates at the end of the forum when he denied that the city had left any money on the table. And I just have to say it was not pretty and particularly not a good ending for him in that forum. And again, Jessen Farrell was too vague and lacked command of the details at the city level. She's great on policy, great on regional issues and state issues, because that's where she was a state representative. But when it comes down to the details of cities, the ins and outs of the city, she's not real clear on those. She's got a lot of homework still to do. Echohawk was enthusiastic, but I don't think knowledgeable enough. And I'm a little worried about her ability to manage people in an orderly way. And Bruce Harrell was more focused with his answers, but those answers were terrible, including his love and support of Charter Amendment 29. Houston was wonky again, I think, in the best of ways, but perhaps a little too idealistic to be a good mayor. I don't know. Depends on whether you think his policies are workable or not. Which brings us to another forum that happened this week, the Downtown Seattle Association Mayoral Candidate Forum, which was which was held so that the downtown business community could see the candidates bow and scrape, essentially. Essex Porter from Cairo 7 and Chris Daniels of King 5 hosted the virtual forum. And, of course, it was very business-centered, which may be why it was attended by only four of the six candidates. Andrew Grant Houston and Jessen Farrell were not there. And for the first time, I got a look at Art Langley and what he's about. Now, before the forum, the Downtown Seattle Association sent a questionnaire to each of the candidates with only one question on it, asking for their plan to revitalize downtown. Andrew Grant Houston and Jessen Farrell have not responded to the questionnaire, but Colleen Echohawk, Bruce Harrell, Art Langley, Lance Randall, and Casey Sixkiller did respond, and the DSA has posted their responses on their website. Lorena Gonzalez, however, refused to answer that question and wrote a response that was then printed later in The Stranger. Essentially, her response was that she has a plan for the entire city that focuses on workers and small businesses and is not just a plan for downtown, and particularly not for big businesses who are primarily located downtown. Now, that earned her a scolding right off the bat from Chris Daniels, and it didn't get any better for her from there. This was basically, you know, gather around and kiss the ring to see who could show the most love for Amazon and other big businesses downtown. Art Langley led the charge with his, you know, Seattle is dying mantra, which he just kept hammering on over and over throughout the forum, which was then enthusiastically echoed by Bruce Harrell, Lance Randall, and Casey Sixkiller. Okay, another time when Casey Sixkiller is basically saying, I failed. My job.
Well, and Bruce Harrell did too, since of course downtown.
Yeah, he was on the council until very recently.
Yep, for 10 years, yeah.
Yeah, and then to my surprise, Colleen Echohawk caved in very quickly, and she lined up right behind the boys to bow and scrape for the DSA too. You know, and it didn't help that every time Art Langley bemoaned the horrible state of downtown Seattle, Colleen Echohawk would jump in with, "I'm shocked. I'm mortified." And even at one point, "I'm embarrassed that it's come to this."
has she been downtown recently? My goodness.
No. Although, you know, I think she ought to be embarrassed by her terrible overwrought performance at this forum, you know. And I think
I said a week or two ago that my impression of her was that what she said changed depending on her audience.
Yes, and that's exactly right. And I think it really shows how compromised she is, you know, and essentially how gullible she is, that her answers change and kind of adapt with whoever is in the audience. And they're not really based on her understanding of the details or understanding of how city government works or that she doesn't really have a sound platform or belief system to fall back on.
I was basing my impression on two things. Number one, the plasticity of her answers in her own town halls, and which I saw. Yeah. And number two, her fundraising success with downtown businesses.
Oh yeah.
And the fact that what she was saying in her town halls didn't really line up with that.
Yeah.
So I figured she must be changing her answers.
Oh yeah. I feel
good about that impression right now.
Yeah. Now, I know a lot of people really like her because she's a woman of color who has a lot of youthful enthusiasm, and it's really easy to get energized by someone who has a lot of enthusiasm, but she is very much a Durkin team player. She is very supportive of the business community and the Downtown Seattle Association, including the largest corporations in the city, which at least one of which is one of the largest corporations in the world at this point. And she seems way too gullible to me. Now, with Houston and Farrell having chickened out, that left Lorena Gonzalez as the only adult in the room. She had to say, I think more than once, that workers, renters, and mom and pop businesses are the ones who've really suffered during the pandemic. And that she's going to try to help them instead of giving money and tax breaks to big businesses who've seen their profits triple during the last year, by which she means Amazon, of course. And each time she'd say that, she'd look into her camera with this deer in the headlights look. Like she just couldn't believe she had to actually remind these Neanderthals of what is really happening in the city and how hard people, ordinary people are struggling. But, you know, she stuck it out and she spoke truth to power. And I think she should get some credit for that.
If you go down Third Avenue downtown, like between Pike and Union, there's a whole string of tent encampments that sprung up when I think about five businesses in a row have folded. And most of those businesses were small businesses. They were not, I mean, one was Starbucks, but you know, most of them were small businesses. And, you know, that's really who's suffering downtown. It just, you know, Amazon's got plenty of new office space downtown. They're doing just fine, thank you. But it really is the small businesses that, in terms of the retail storefronts that are the problem downtown right now, in terms of those closing. And there's a reason those tent encampments spring up so quickly. And, you know, that has to be addressed too.
Yeah. And so, and I have to say, so far, if I had to score the candidates, the two candidates who have really shown a good grasp of the details are Andrew Grant Houston and Lorena Gonzalez. Jessen Farrell is a pretty close third. But she doesn't quite have the experience in local government, but I think she could get up to speed if she had to. Whether she's as progressive as Houston or Gonzalez, I don't know yet. And that's another question. Now, at this point, Echo Hawk and Harrell have both turned in subpar performances, and choosing Casey Sixkiller, of course, would be supporting the Durkin administration's failed policies, which even Sixkiller has admitted are failing. So the field has divided now into two bunches, with three very different progressives on one side and three business-as-usual Democrats on the other side. And then a couple of trailing candidates who are Republicans, like Lance Randall and Art Langley, who are not getting nearly the support that you would expect in a city as liberal as Seattle. So next week, I'll talk about police, gun violence, and community justice. And we'll look at where the candidates stand.
That should be entertaining.
Oh, I think so.
Okay. Sticking with the electoral system, the Charter Amendment 29 got the signatures they needed, or declared they had the signatures they needed.
Compassion Seattle submitted 64,155 signatures to the office of the city clerk on Thursday this week. That's not quite double the 33,060 signatures that will be required to put the initiative on the ballot. The next step is for the King County Department of Elections to validate the signatures, then refer the amendment to the city council to either pass it or place it on the ballot. Now, the campaign to support Charter Amendment 29 has already raised $926,353 from about 295 donors. That's an average of over $3,000 per donor, with a number of donors giving between $25,000 to $50,000. And it's worthwhile to just very quickly look at who the major funders of Compassion Seattle are. So, right at the top there with their $50,000 contributions are folks like John Goodman, and who's the chairman, and George Petrie, who's the CEO of Goodman Real Estate, a major developer that owns $2.5 billion in mid-market commercial and residential real estate across the United States and Canada. That comes out to about 40,000 apartment units and 2.5 million square feet of office space. They're right at the top there. Martin Smith, Inc. is also gave $50,000. That's another developer who owns over a dozen office buildings and commercial real estate properties in Seattle, including Piers 55 and 56 and several historic buildings in downtown and Pioneer Square. Vulcan, Inc., of course, is on the list. That's Paul Allen's real estate and investment company, now run by his sister, Jody. It's one of the major developers in the Puget Sound region with $4.4 billion in assets, including 3,390 residential units and 7.9 million square feet of commercial space, 70% of which is located in South Lake Union. John Hemingway is another major contributor. He's chairman of Carex Inc., which was formerly SSA Marine, which is now the largest marine terminal operator in the western United States and one of the world's largest providers of software to the port industry worldwide. So another big player in Seattle politics there. And then Christopher Larson, the retired Microsoft executive and minority owner of the Seattle Mariners baseball team, has also donated majorly. Also on the list is Urban Visions, a real estate company that owns several large buildings downtown and other properties throughout the city. And the Washington Multifamily Housing Association, that's the trade association for real estate developers who build apartment buildings in Washington state. Other supporters include the Downtown Seattle Association, Weyerhaeuser, Building Owners and Managers, Seattle King County, Unico Properties, developers Matt Griffin of Pine Street Group, and Tim Seiss of CBE Strategic, which is a major property management company, Michael Dunn of Dunn Lumber, and the Soto Business Improvement District, as well as the Associated General Contractors of Washington, and on and on and on. So all of these real estate companies and landlords in the city center. Now, if you look at the list of contributors by district, it shows that 57% of donations come from District 7, which is downtown, Belltown, Queen Anne, and Magnolia, with the next biggest chunk being 16% from outside the city limits. Third highest is 8% from District 3, particularly the wealthy areas of Madison Park and Madrona, I'm guessing. A full 9% is from a combination of Seattle P.O. Box and Uncodable. So that tells you, the support behind Compassion Seattle is all these big real estate and business owners in downtown who some of them live in Madrona and Madison Park. Some of them may live in big condos downtown, but I think a lot of them live on the east side in, you know, Hunts Point and places like that.
So the impression that I have is that this is the strategy that was settled upon by the people who couldn't buy city council seats 2 years ago.
Yes, that would be a very accurate description, I think, of what's going on here.
So they couldn't buy the city council seats, so now they're trying to constrain city council by putting on the city charter how city council should spend its budgetary money.
Yeah, that brings me to what is actually in Charter Amendment 29. And I read it.
Oh, do tell.
Yes, I read it this week all the way through. It's not long. It includes some things that progressive folks really do want, like a housing mandate for homeless people and a requirement that they be offered mental health and diversion services that are culturally appropriate and focus on racial equity. And it would enshrine those in the city charter. And I want to point out that those things were added later after the initiative was first released and then got a lot of criticism from homeless service providers. Then the Compassion Seattle group went back and added those things to the charter amendment. However, it would also add to the city charter the following language. Quote, while there is no right to camp in any particular public space, it is city policy to avoid as much as possible dispersing people, except to safe and secure housing, unless, and here's the big kicker, right? Unless remaining in place poses particular problems related to public health or safety or interferes with the use of the public spaces by others. In those circumstances where the city does not close an encampment, the city may still require individuals to shift their belongings and any structures to ensure safety, accessibility, and to accommodate use of public spaces, end quote.
So that's pretty similar to the Durkin policy.
Yeah, that would enshrine sweeps. So Andrew Grant Houston is absolutely right about that. This charter amendment would enshrine sweeps in the city charter, and it would prioritize people walking their dogs in the park over people needing a place to sleep at night, essentially. So that means Charter Amendment 29, of course, would put that all into the city charter for the next 6 years. It has a sunset clause that means it would end on December 31st, 2027. But for the next 6 years, it would be not only legal, but the city's obligation to sweep homeless encampments out of parks and public spaces.
Yeah, no matter what that radical city council wants to do.
Yeah. Now, of course, Charter Amendment 29 contains no funding mechanism. There's nothing in there that says that that would say, you know, here's where the city council would draw the funding from, or here's how it could raise funds. It assumes that there already is and always will be, and that's important, always will be plenty of money in the city budget available to fund permanent supportive housing with wraparound services, which is actually quite expensive, more expensive than I think the drafters of the charter amendment actually realize. And we're not even talking yet about what would happen when the eviction moratorium ends in September and we have not 8,000 people on the streets of the city, but 18,000 or perhaps more. So that's Charter Amendment 29. And that's why homeless service providers and many of the candidates for the city council, particularly the three most progressive ones, are against it. But of course, not Bruce Harrell and not Casey Sixkiller. That was kind of a long discussion of the mayoral candidates, but it's very important that people be clear on who supports what and where we are with these candidates.
Yeah, that was a good wrap up. Again, the Downtown Seattle Association is also often referred to as the DSA, not to be confused with our local chapter of the
Democratic Socialists of America. Yes. Yeah. Not the same group.
Not the same group at all. In fact, it'd be pretty entertaining to get those two groups in the same room at one time.
I think that's sort of like putting matter and antimatter in the same place. You don't really want to see the results.
Yeah. Now, I'm not clear that whether the DSA, I looked for the information on this, but I wasn't clear whether the DSA had even invited Andrew Grant Houston to the forum, but I couldn't actually see anywhere where they noted who they had invited and not invited. So I can't say that they didn't invite him. But I think he was kind of wise not to go in for the beating that Lorena Gonzalez took from the other candidates at that pretty terrible let's line up and bow our foreheads to the ground for Amazon party.
Yeah. Well, I've never met him, but my impression is, in a forum like that, he would be the one doing the beating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think maybe members of his, maybe he had someplace else to be there, that was more productive on that day,
he had an important little league game to attend.
Yeah. Or maybe, someone on his team said, Andrew, no, let's just not do that.
All right. Let's move on. Still plenty to cover. And this week's update on our pandemic.
Yeah. Washington State ended its COVID restrictions this week, which you got a whole lot of media cheerleading about that. Unfortunately, the pandemic is not over. Both statewide and nationally, we've seen an uptick in the last week in the number of confirmed new cases, and that is primarily a result of the Delta variant, which we're hearing a lot about right now. That's the one that originated in India and is now posing a problem really all over the world. And I'll get to that in a minute. But it is over a quarter of new infections in the United States right now. That's up from 20% a week ago and 7% a month ago. So it's increasing the number of new infections and spreading really quickly, as it has done in virtually every other country in the world. And the United States is a much larger pool of unvaccinated people than a lot of other industrialized countries that have fallen prey to this. So particularly in states that have low vaccination rates, I'm looking at you, the old Confederacy, since virtually all of those states are at the bottom of the number of states. In particular, Arkansas now has 56% of its cases being Delta. And Arkansas, Missouri, and Utah are the three states that are the highest per capita new infection rates in the country. Their rates are increasing quite rapidly. I think we're going to see a new spike this summer, and it is really not the time for Washington State to be opening everything up. But, you know, that's what Jay Inslee wanted to do, and so that's what's happening. Much to the delight of the business community, and I think they're going to regret that, honestly, because we've still got, 30% of the population being completely unvaccinated, and more like 40% or so that has not been fully vaccinated in Washington State. So that's a concern. Even in King County, that is a concern. we are nowhere near anything approaching herd immunity. We are dramatically lower in the number of new cases that we're registering, but I think those cases are going to start creeping up again the next couple weeks. That, unfortunately, is my prediction. I would love to be wrong about that. The Delta variant is creating all kinds of problems internationally as well. We're seeing countries like Israel, Russia, having problems. Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, is having a huge outbreak, driven by the Delta variant and driven by the coup, the right-wing coup on February 1st. That coup resulted in the new government of Myanmar dismantling the vaccination program that was primarily targeting the elderly and sending those doses instead to soldiers, which tells you where their priority was. And also that coup triggered a general strike across the economic sector of the country, including its healthcare workers. So its healthcare system has been on strike for the last several months, and the vaccination program has ground to a halt among the general public. This is not a good combination, and the Delta variant is taking full advantage. It does not care what your politics are, but boy, it sure seems to love right-wing regimes. And yeah, that's where we are. The Delta variant is the biggest focus of concern among epidemiologists and public health officials right now. But we're simply not hearing that from our elected officials. We're hearing a little bit about that from the Biden administration. Biden on Thursday pledged a new sweeping program to try and put resources into combating the Delta variant. He also, we also had a number of studies this week that verified that existing vaccines, including Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and Moderna, which are the three that have been authorized in the United States, are all very effective against the Delta variant. So this is primarily spreading among unvaccinated people, younger people, unvaccinated people, et cetera. So,
just a reminder that it's not only more easier to spread, it's also, tends to bring on a much more severe illness than the original, version of the COVID virus. So if you haven't been vaccinated yet or haven't gotten your second shot, now is the time.
Yeah.
No time better than now.
And, I mean, we had this certainly come up with the heat wave this past week. But if you're hanging out in indoor spaces, indoor public spaces, I would keep wearing a mask because you have no idea who's vaccinated and who's not. And even though the vaccines are very effective against the Delta variant, they're not 100% effective. No vaccine is. So, better to be safe. A piece of cloth is better than getting COVID.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on. We're short on time.
Okay. A lot of people were expecting an outcome on Thursday regarding the Trump Organization. Did you catch any of that?
Oh, yeah, they got one. 10 felony counts against the Trump Organization and 15 against their CFO, Alan Weisselberg. The speculation is that those charges are meant to pressure Weisselberg to flip and testify against Donald Trump. Typically the way federal prosecutors build cases against, for example, the mob, to pick a random example, is to start with the lower tier people and work their way up. And they're to the second in commands now. Weisselberg has worked very closely with Donald Trump in his business pretty much since Trump got out of grad school. He worked with Trump's father before that. So he's in his 70s. He's looking at spending the rest of his life in jail unless he testifies against Donald Trump. Now, the charges against Weisselberg are primarily tax charges, and they have to do with the Trump Organization over a period of 15 years systematically taking a lot of their expenses off book, particularly how they compensate their high level executive personnel, buying things with those personnel, things like private school for their kids, apartments in Manhattan and Florida, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Stuff that is not normally considered part of the expenses of a real estate company, but were included, and they kept two sets of books, which is particularly a damning thing, and particularly convenient for federal prosecutors, because prosecutors can look at those two sets of books and tell exactly, and not only exactly how much the Trump Organization should have paid in taxes that it wasn't, but that they were conscious that they were evading taxes. So the intent is there as well. So it's a pretty strong indictment. A couple of important things to note about this, that the charges against Weisselberg in the New York Times reporting last year of the Trump taxes, it was clear that Ivanka Trump was getting compensated in the same way that Weisselberg just got charged for. So there's a lot of speculation now that she may be next. And if Trump wasn't already needing to be peeled off the ceiling, having his sometimes lover and full-time daughter charged with felonies probably would do it. And of course, you know, he loves her, but only because she's got his DNA, right? He's really loving himself, or a version of himself. And if that doesn't fully creep you out, I don't know what would. But so that's one item to note. The other item to note is that as we've known for a couple of years now, the Trump Organization has a number of loans coming due worth hundreds of millions of dollars in the next few years. Most bank loans have provisions in them that would trigger those loans being called in if something happens, like being indicted for tax fraud. So this may financially destroy the Trump Organization, even if it never goes to trial. And that is something that people who are familiar with high-end real estate finance are talking about a lot right now, is that this may be the financial end of the Trump Organization, even if those charges don't stick. So that's what happened this week, and a lot of people are expecting more charges to come.
Yeah, I think also what's interesting here is these are state tax related charges by the New York State. It's not federal charges, and I think if members of the Trump Organization like Weisselberg were convicted of state tax fraud, then I think the IRS would be forced to step in and file federal charges.
Yeah, if you look at the charging document, they include details on federal tax fraud.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
Uh-huh.
So that's part of the charging documents. So we'll see if the feds pick up on that. Of course, it's politically loaded, but if the state has already gone before, it might make it easier for the DOJ to step in.
And Biden has stepped back from it, saying that he's not going to even follow it, you know, because it's not part of what the president's job. And Merrick Garland, the head of the Department of Justice, has said that he's going to kind of let his own investigators do what they naturally do, and he's not going to influence them either way on this. So we'll see if a lawsuit comes out of the Department of Justice.
Yes. And somewhere I imagine that Hunter Biden is laughing his ass off.
Hunter Biden. Yeah. Yeah.
I think all the speculation about Donald Trump running for president in 2024, doesn't presume that he's going to be tied up in court. And I think he probably will be.
If not in prison.
Yeah. Although I he's got enough money that he can appeal things. So. Almost endlessly. So, I think more likely he'll not be in prison, but he'll be very, very busy with legal proceedings.
All right.
And speaking engagements where he can complain that he's being targeted by a witch hunt. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like that. So it's a good fundraising tool for him, but, he won't have the kind of credibility necessary to make a meaningful run for president. I hope.
All right. So a couple minutes left. Update on the Champlain Towers disaster collapse.
Yeah, and we a couple important things happened yesterday. One is that the north side of that tower, which did not collapse last week, was condemned by the county this week. So that's going to come down as well. And then a 10-story condo complex in North Miami Beach, about 7 miles to the south, was evacuated on almost no notice yesterday for similar kind of structural concerns. And once again, it's an older building dating from the early 70s. It was up for reauthorization, and the county looked at the data that it got from that reauthorization, said this has all kinds of structural issues. They're the same kind of structural concerns that were identified in Champlain Towers. People who are living there need to get out right now. And so they are. And they're still looking for survivors in Champlain. That may be complicated by the fact that the Hurricane Elsa is likely to hit Florida in a couple of days. So people are scrambling around that. But it's not looking good right now. 20 people have been confirmed dead, but over 120 are still considered missing.
Okay, in 1 minute, summarize the Supreme Court ruling on Arizona's voting restrictions.
Well, I could summarize it in two words, but one of them is something you can't say on the radio. it's screwed. Let's leave it at that. Yeah, the Supreme Court in a 6-3 ruling upheld Arizona's voting rights restrictions. And the most damning part of their decision was, yeah, it disproportionately affects minorities, BIPOC, people who are historically disadvantaged in the polls, but it's not a statistically meaningful number. Now, this flies in the face of the whole idea that, you know, every vote counts, votes can be decided by razor-thin margins, particularly in a swing state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the Supreme Court decided to ignore all that rhetoric in favor of, well, those votes aren't really important anyway. That is a really, really dangerous precedent, and one could see them building on that in the future. Meantime, it's going to make the lawsuits, such as the ones DOJ and a number of activist organizations have brought against the state of Georgia, much more difficult thing to prove, because you have to prove not only the intent of racial discrimination, but the intent of racial discrimination that is statistically meaningful. So yeah, it was a terrible decision.
Yeah, and the ball's kind of in Congress's court at this point, though I don't see the Senate being able to pass anything unless they do something about the filibuster.
Yes, and I'm not sure that's going to happen.
No, not either.
All right. Well, we are going to leave it there for this week and reel you both in same time next week.
To be continued.
Oh, yes.
All right.